Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, welcome to another Rahulastapur book club. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Crewe, who's talking about his fantastic new novel, The New Life. Hello, Tom.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'll say right at the top, because, you know, we have to be open about these things. Tom, you are the partner of my brother-in-law.
That's true.
Duncan.
That's true. Yes, it's finally paying off.
It's him. But I think it's probably, if the nepotism is working here, it's going the other way, because you're a very hot new novelist. You're in the... Were you the hottest new novelist in The Guardian? Was that... You were number one of 10?
Yes, the Observer, yes.
Yeah, the Observer.
Yes,
yeah, so things are going very well with The New Life, which is a fantastic novel. I really enjoyed it. So we're connected through that. Also, your family come from Middlesbrough, as mine do. And we may talk about this more. There is a kind of connection there as well. But we'll talk about that later. Though I'm quite interested that both of our partners who are brother and sister, have decided to date people who come from, you know, at least come in some degree from Middlesbrough, and whether that's some kind of kink within the Wilkins family.
I wouldn't want to ask you too many personal details, but it's certainly a kink in my household, yeah.
It's a weird thing to want to be with someone from Middlesbrough, but here we are. I don't count myself as being from Middlesbrough, but my parents both are. We'll talk about that later. So, Tom, for people who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to write a novel and what you were doing before you wrote a novel?
Well, in my day job, I am an editor at the London Review of Books, where I have been for not that far off 10 years. And before that, I did a PhD in late 19th century history, which had some bearing on my novel.
Yeah.
But I have spent my whole life wanting to write a novel and write fiction, and I've kind of worked my way up to it finally after finding the time and working in the mornings and lunchtimes and weekends. And the novel is is finally here. And it's a novel I had the idea for, again, about 10 years ago before I started work at the LRB. So it's been a long journey.
And so tell us a little bit about the novel and why you thought this is it's based on history. It's based on real people, but it's slightly you've fictionalized things and changed things a little bit, I think it's fair to say. But the basis of it is in fact, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
So it's about the novel's about two men who both live in London in the 1890s. The novel starts in 1894. And they decide to write a book together. And the book is going to be the first ever book in English about homosexuality, where they will argue that homosexuality, being gay, is natural and harmless. It's like colorblindness. It's just something you're born with. And that the law, which makes all sex between men in public and private a crime, is unjust. It's founded on false principles and it should be abolished and people should be free to live their life. So they're making this very bold revolutionary argument at the end of the Victorian era. They're both married men. One is a gay man who's been married for 30 years, has three adult children. That's John. And he's sort of coming to terms with his sexuality for the first time in mature life. And he's begun a kind of love affair with a younger man called Frank, a working class man. And Henry, the other man, he's also married, but he's married to a lesbian, which he's aware of. He knows he's marrying a lesbian, though he doesn't quite realize everything that involves. And his wife, Edith, who is a feminist and a socialist and a kind of progressive thinker, as Henry is, they think of themselves as having a very progressive, new kind of marriage. But Edith has fallen in love with another woman called Angelica. And that's creating problems. So these two men, they're both in crowded marriages, three people in each marriage. They're writing this book. And just as they're about to publish this book in 1895, Oscar Wilde gets caught up in his trial. And yeah. they have to decide what to do next.
Yeah, it's a very moving and story. And it's very sad, you know. I mean, it just makes you... You know, the whole thing just made me think how terrible it is that for all these people, and it's not just about gay people, but the gay man's been forced to marry. It's about class. It's about feminism and women being treated unequally as well, and working class people being treated badly as well. You know, but all these people having to live these lives, not being able to be who they really are, which obviously. It resonates a little. I mean, hopefully things are better now, but some are not perfect. But equally, you know, we still have this idea of convention and people have to behave in a certain way. The book we talked about last week was about the Beatles and James Bond. And it's kind of interesting how much the 60s changed. How rapidly social change came in the 1960s that even before even before the Beatles, Britain was still, the UK particularly was still very much kind of mired in that Victorian values, but we haven't shed, you know, it's not been shed. The class stuff, the feminism stuff and the kink stuff, or, you know, or the unconventional lifestyle stuff, or the different way of viewing yourself stuff, that being born and feeling that you're different than other people, is still here, isn't it? So it does sort of resonate in a very sad way.
Yes, I think so. I hope so. I didn't write it thinking so much about the modern day resonances, but I think they are there. And I hope if the book has a long life, then it's because it still speaks to those kind of human constants. But as you say, some of them are there. And I do think a lot of this stuff wasn't worked out till the 60s. I think you're right. I mean, the 1950s was the worst time to be gay in Britain in terms of arrests and sentences. Right. And one of the things that the novel is trying to show that it's not all doom and gloom. People did get by. Gay people had to live their lives and they did meet people and have experiences of various kinds. So it's about showing a society which kind of corrupts individuals, doesn't let individuals be themselves. And actually that can turn good people into bad people, turn people against other people. So, you know, so John, the gay man here, you know, the book deals a lot with how he is married to this woman, Catherine, who he ends up treating very badly, can't help but treat badly in his bid to be a better version of himself. So it is about a society which forces people into different shapes, the wrong shape, and pushes them in the wrong directions. But I do want to try and show that people lived, people had lives. Sure. They got through somehow.
Yeah, and I think there's an element where, I mean, because of the danger involved in any alternate lifestyle, then that you know, it's a very sexual book. There's a lot of sex in it, a lot of you know, very well described and romantic and non-romantic incidents that happen. Yes. But I get, you know, there's an element that there's a thrill to the danger that someone, you know, that Frank in the first place could be just someone who's been sent to try and trick John to get him arrested. But the book opens with a scene on a train where the two men are pressed together and are strangers and can't see each other, but end up having quite raucous time. But you know, it's like, I want to say to you, Tom, you know, I write about spunking up all the time. That's all I write about, and I'm not in the Observer as being one of the best writers, and this book is full of a lot of descriptions of spunk flying everywhere. It's better than I can put it.
Yeah, no,
it's
no,
more imaginative than it's spunk flying everywhere, but it's basically a lot of that. So it, you know, there is a sort of thrill to it. So it's, you know, it's quite in a sense, that forbidden nature of it and that danger heightens all of these emotions to a kind of terrifying but sort of exciting degree as well. That's part of it, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, as you say, you know, a lifelong interest in spunk has been translated into an exciting new career or a different kind of career. And so that's very gratifying, obviously. Yes, I mean, I've been amazed really at how, I'm very pleased that people like the sex scenes. Lots of people do like the sex scenes and think they've been done well. But it's also amazing how many people on Goodreads or Amazon, you know, are throwing the book out the window because they just can't bear the sex. You know, it's too much. They're so mortified and prudish, I think. Which is very interesting when the books are set in the 1890s and it's about people trying to overcome prudishness and priggishness. And here we are 120 years later, the same thing is happening. But for me, the sex scenes are, you know, it's not just titillation. As you say, partly it's about trying to show pleasure being grasped in dark places and secret places and what that feels like. But it's also a book about, in a kind of more intellectual sense, I suppose, it's about sex and how sex makes people feel and what it means to embrace a sexual life when maybe the society is telling you shouldn't. And so the character of John begins this affair with Frank, as you say, and he's having an intellectual awakening. He's decided he wants to kind of adopt a gay rights position, what we would now call a gay rights position. But if the book was just about that, it would be rather dry. And actually what gives that mission its kind of momentum and personal drama is the fact that he's also having a sexual awakening at the same time as an intellectual awakening. And if he didn't have that physical side to things, you wouldn't feel, you know, the intellectual arguments would just be a little bit thin, I think. And Henry on the other side, he does have a sex scene, but actually it's a failed sex scene. He fails to have sex with his wife. It's a kind of, you know, cringe-inducing moment, which was just as interesting to write, actually, and written maybe in a similar way, because I do think you can write sex in, I think it probably has to be about stages and motions and movements. And that can work in reverse. It can go really well or it can go really badly. And each movement, each gesture, each touch here, touch there can go badly wrong, as it does for Henry. So he's struggling to actually find a sexuality, and we started talking about kinks, and he does have a kink. And he, in a way, finds it harder to talk about his kink, which is to see women urinate. He finds it harder to talk about that than some of the gay characters find it to talk about their sexuality in the 1890s. And I do think actually now, I mean, it, you know, I think it raises more giggles and more embarrassment now to talk about urophilia or urolania and the various words for it, or piss fetish. I think we find it harder to talk about that now than we do to find, talk about gay people and what they get up to. And that's very interesting too. So this is a man in the 1890s trying to find a way to talk about that aspect of his sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think the fact that, you know, there was so much riding on, you know, if the, there was so much punishment potentially for these acts, that the fact that people still found a way to make them happen or and still wanted to do them, it sort of shows very clearly that this isn't something that it's not like, oh, I'm going to choose to be this way because you know, just for the fun of it. It's something that's innate. It's something that you can't stop through a law, and yes, that it's kind of, yeah. I mean, obviously with Oscar Wilde, it's the tragedy of Oscar Wilde is well known. And I love the way in the book that, you know, it's not an afterthought. It's sort of looming over the whole book if you know what's coming. But equally, once that trial happens, obviously it affects this book that the men are compiling, because are they going to get prosecuted? Are they going to go to prison? Will they be shunned by society? But all of the, you know, it sort of does make you think. I mean, and it is about this as well, but it's about being that first person to risk your own personal safety and your own personal life and those and the people around you for the good of other people. So obviously these guys are making, risking personal sacrifice and the sacrifice for their families, embarrassment for their families, but they, you know, they understand, or one of them particularly understands, I think, that for the future, for the new life, if things are going to change, someone's going to have to do it. It's I guess we don't often think about that personal cost for those people who are brave enough to be the ones to say this is wrong.
I mean, the book is very engaged with that problem. You know, how do we achieve change in our society? And this is another thing, I suppose, that makes it relevant to now and to you know, maybe it kind of gives it a universality, that it is about how do we achieve change? Do we change society by changing ourselves? Do we change society by changing society in a big structural sense? And what does it mean to bring change about? How do we do it? And does it need someone to do that big brave thing and put their head above the parapet, as you say, and admit something? I mean, there's a quote in the book by George Bernard Shaw, said in the 1890s, the problem is, it's not actually that people, you know, educated, thoughtful people don't at home know some gay people and talk about the gay people they know and say, oh, you know, yes, we're very relaxed about this and that's fine. That's not the problem. It's actually what people are prepared to say in public. Yeah. And he says, none of these men who, you know, talk very composedly about gay people at home dare to say in public that they think it should be legal, because otherwise people might think that they're gay, and yes, and that's just too much to bear. It's too terrible a prospect. So the book is very interested in that question. What if someone, and lots of the gay people in the book are asking themselves this question, what if I was brave enough? What if someone is brave enough to get up and say, look at me, look at my life. Are you going to really tell me that, you know, this harmless life is so toxic and dangerous and terrible, and you want to put me in prison? What for loving someone and, you know, and feeling love in the same way that you feel love, the same love I see in books and plays? You're telling me my version is a crime? So they're asking themselves that all the time, and this is where the Wilde trial comes in, because my characters actually have a very negative view of Oscar Wilde. They are very upset with him, we've rehabilitated him as the ultimate gay martyr. But he was very stupid. He got himself into this trial. It was his own fault. He sued his boyfriend's father, the Marquess of Queensbury, who said that Wilde was gay, and Wilde sued him and said, "I'm not gay. That's a lie. I'm going to take you to court," when he knew perfectly well that it was true. So he got himself into this case. And then, of course, as part of the libel trial, Queensbury's lawyers found all these boys Wilde had been having sex with and brought the evidence forward and said, "Look, he's not lying, because look at this." And so Wilde really got himself into the mess in the first place, and then got up in court and said, "I'm not gay." Denied everything. Said the boys were lying. Said that these working class young men were lying, telling lies. The whole thing was a figment. And kind of under pressure, he then went a bit further and said, "Oh, actually, yes, maybe I was hanging out with young men, but actually it was very pure. It was completely, you know, it was the Greeks. It's like Plato. It's completely chaste and very elevating. And actually, you know, it's in the Bible." And my characters, sort of particularly the character of John, resents this, because he thinks, you haven't had the bravery to own up to it. You were stupid enough to get yourself into this situation, and then you haven't been brave enough to say that you actually are gay. And instead, when confronted with this evidence of you being just a bit of a perv or a dissolute kind of character, you've tried to dress it up as ideal and magnificent and pure and chaste, when it's none of those things at all. So they are unhappy with Wilde, as I think, you know, looking at the course of gay history, I think we can wonder if Wilde hadn't got himself into all that trouble, would the course of gay rights have been different? And that's a question the book is also interested in. Would one of these other figures, so my character John is based on a real figure called John Addington Symonds, who did have these kinds of gay rights views. What if a man like that lived to see the Oscar Wilde trial? Because Symonds did not live to see it, and my book is a sort of exploration. What if someone who, unlike Wilde, is very self-conscious and articulate about being gay and wants to do something about it, what if that person sees Wilde get up in that court and deny everything and bring shame and tawdriness on the cause that he holds so close to his heart?
Yeah, I mean, that's all really interesting, and it is. And the court case, which I think uses a lot of the real questions from the case, and is you know, a very interesting reading as well, and a very upsetting reading as well.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's interesting where you're taking real people and changing things. So a lot of the main characters are sort of based on real people. Why did you, I mean, obviously you've sort of partly explained it there so that you can see what would have happened if he'd been around to see that, and he wasn't around to see that trial. But what responsibility do you feel to the original people, and what was the, you know, what was the balance of truth and fiction for you in when you came to writing this? Because that's a delicate thing to do. I mean, obviously none of these people are around to complain about it, but you've changed the names a little bit. How much thought went into that, and how did you balance it?
Well, I mean, so I was a historian, you know, I did a PhD in history, so I was, I suppose, officially a historian, and I think there was a little bit of sort of kicking my heels and just cutting loose from the facts and enjoying feeling that reckless irresponsibility, and just for once I don't have to copy everything down properly and footnote, and I've enjoyed that freedom to kind of elaborate on history or take history off its proper path into a kind of different space, because I actually think it's a very interesting and useful way to think about history is through fiction, is to try and dramatize historical issues. And that might not mean you dramatize history as the late great Hilary Mantel wanted to, as keeping as close to the facts as possible and filling in the gaps where there are gaps. That's what she believed was the right thing to do in fiction if you were writing fiction set in the past. But actually, I think you can serve history just as well, explore the reality of history just as well by doing something different, by actually going against the course of historical events, because it allows you to shine a light on different aspects of the same situation, kind of almost run a sort of experiment. What would have happened if might so-and-so have done X? And that's very helpful. You know, mm-hmm. You can do an experiment with an accepted set of realities and see what comes out of it. And it will tell you things about that given reality. And so I think that's my sort of justification for departing from the facts. If I wanted to give a justification, if I didn't want to say, oh, I just fancied kicking up my heels. So from the very beginning, I was very comfortable with that decision, because what had grasped my attention, what had really got me going and thinking about this novel, was this idea that, or my discovery that the 1890s was actually a very optimistic time for people, gay people, thinking about what we would now call gay rights, that people across Europe were considering whether homosexuality was really a crime or a sin or a medical problem, or whether it was just something natural and human. And there was an optimism about whether the law in Britain could be changed. Homosexuality had been legalized in Italy in 1889, a few years before my book starts. It was already legal in France and various other European countries. So it wasn't completely crazy thinking that they could do this. And I was very interested in exploring that, discovering that, because it's something we don't really know, I think. And the reason we don't know about it is because the Oscar Wilde trial came along like a meteor and just hits Britain and unleashes this terrible wave of homophobia, public homophobia, and creates a kind of gay stereotype, you know. Gay people spend the next 60 years or longer trying to get away from being thought to be like Oscar Wilde. Theatrical, camp, exotic, funnily dressed, you know, always making funny little camp jokes and sleeping with working class boys and perhaps most of all, just being doomed, being tragic. I mean, Wilde is a doomed figure. So I wanted to, this is a long answer to the question, I wanted to show that hinge moment. How do we go from optimism and excitement to disaster and homophobia? I wanted to kind of show the excitement and show the loss and bring that moment to life. And in order to do that, I actually had to step away from the facts, but I think it was worthwhile.
And then
lashings of spunk just to help the whole thing, to help the whole thing go down easily.
Beautifully described, spunk. Yeah, how do you think the real men and women would feel? I mean, do you think they'd be happy that modern society is finally a bit closer to what they were aiming for? Or do you think they would be upset? I mean, it's the feeling, especially with the marriage, the gay man married to the straight woman, and the sort of weight. Just it feels, and it's not a wasted life because it's not only part of a life, but. And no life is wasted, but it just, what an awful waste of time to force a gay man to marry a woman. Do you think they would, I mean, do you think they'd be happy about this book? Do you think they would be happy about the way the world is now? Or do you think they would feel, fucking hell, you know, how did it take, 100 years and we're still really not even there yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think they would, I think they, so... My John character is based on Addington Symonds, as I've said, and my Henry character is based on a guy called Havelock Ellis, who became very, very famous in the 20th century as a sort of pioneer sexologist. He wrote these books called the, I'm actually going to forget what they're called, Studies in the Psychology of Sex. And these were the books that kind of people took down from the library shelves, you know, as kind of dirty books to learn something about, and that people were still doing that in the 50s.
Right.
So he did end up having this very long life. He didn't die until 1939.
Right.
Ellis is. And he saw a lot of change. He saw those debates about contraception and women's rights, but he still didn't live long enough to see homosexuality legalized in Britain. And it wasn't legalized until 1967. And I think this is always amazing because we in our kind of, English people in an Anglo-centric way always we fixate on 1967, which was only when homosexuality was legalized in England and in Wales, but it was not astonishingly legalized in Scotland until 1980,
right.
Northern Ireland until 1982, I believe, and Ireland until 1993. So these are incredible facts. So it's a long, long journey. So I think, based on what I've said about that optimism in the 1890s, I think they would have been pretty horrified that it took so long.
Yeah.
Certainly in 1894, certainly before Oscar Wilde is arrested, I think they would have been really quite horrified at how long it took, particularly because the arguments that prevailed in the 1960s, in 1967, were not as bold as the ones that my characters are making in the 1890s. You know, there was such a... In 1967... in England and Wales, there was such a fixation on allowing gay men to have sex in private, behind closed doors. And it was very much about, you know, let people do what they want to do in the secrecy of their own homes. It was a less radical argument about kind of human dignity and human individuality. It wasn't about a kind of public identity for gay people, letting them into the public sphere as legitimate. Citizens. And so I think it was a kind of conservative victory, and it did mean, because of this emphasis on privacy, it actually meant in the 80s, where we have another wave of homophobia to do with AIDS and so on, in the 80s some zealous police officers were arresting men for holding hands on the street in Britain, arresting them for holding hands because it was seen as kind of compromising this almost vague aspect of the law about what you could do in private and what you could do in public.
Yeah.
So I do think they would be rather distressed by that. I think they'd be distressed by all sorts of things to do with capitalism and how the great divide still between the rich and poor, and because that's something else they're thinking about. I think the women characters would probably still be a bit disappointed while being very impressed with the progress made. I think they'd be disappointed at the progress that still is yet to be made. And yes, I forgot.
Yeah, well, I think that's, yeah, but I think that's what part of the book is that class thing. And again, the Beatles book is all about class, but it does strike you when you really think about it, how we're still like beholden to that divide, you know, that we're the Eton politicians, even despite everything they've done in the last 10 years, are still sort of seen as being fit to rule, and the people pay deference to them, and working class people vote for them, and there's still these sort of class divides, which, you know, are ridiculous, and just we sort of accept them. But it's all about conformity, isn't it? And worrying about change, and sort of bedding down in the past in the hope that things will continue to be the same, and that fear of being the one to, I mean, I suppose with social media and everything, you sort of do get a real feeling of if you express a belief on either side, really, that that is controversial, you do get a little bit of that kind of attack that maybe would have been more prevalent in the past than when now it's sort of a hidden thing, but it's clearly still there. There's clearly still homophobia, but there's classism, and there's transphobia, and all kinds of things that people have to deal with. So it is, it did just, as I say, it's a lovely book and it's beautifully written. It just made me quite sad about the human condition, and especially when it comes to things about, it is just about people living their lives. It's not even, they're not, I mean, they're big issues, but they're not big issues. They're tiny issues of love and just how you live and what you do. And for them to be blown up into being so important and have to be hidden away, it does. And as a straight person, I think, again, you know, I'm not as up on that history. So this book is a fantastic way to go, oh my God, yeah, this is, you know, I knew about the Oscar Wilde trial, but I think this, even though Oscar Wilde isn't a major character in this book, it really brings that home, and everything you've said in this interview as well brings that home. But yeah, that attitude and, you know, just the basic, it's just when it's basically stated, it is sort of so ridiculous that anyone is policing the way anybody consensually loves another adult. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, it just feels, what a fucking waste of time for everyone involved, and the effects of it. And I think, you know, I'm very, you know, the wife character, Catherine, isn't it, is, you know, I feel so sad for her. She's not a particularly likable character, but she's sort of been beaten down by this, by helping this guy and knowing what she was getting into, but being left feeling like, I mean, there's stuff about him throwing her waste into her. I mean, all the stuff about their kind of lovelessness of their union is, there's stuff comparing it to mounting horses, and I mean, it's so tragic and horrible, but I feel very sorry for that character, as I'm sure I'm intended to. And what is lovely about this is the characters are so well drawn, and you do, you know, you feel their emotions, and you are sympathetic to all of them, really.
Yeah, I think Catherine's a very important
figure
in the book, because even though she is, by our standards, a homophobe, or, you know, she's not thrilled about her husband being gay. And it was very important, actually, to make readers feel uncomfortable with that situation, to not just readily take John's side, to not immediately feel that kind of natural 21st century sympathy for a gay man trapped in the closet in the 1890s, but to actually see that his behavior impacts so terribly on his wife. And in a way, it's very important to give her perspective and her side of events, because as a novelist, you want to do that. You want to have your complex characters, but she allows us to see that bigger issue, that it's not really about individuals. It's about the society, a society which doesn't allow either person to be free. And I suppose if there is a properly Greek style tragic element in the book, it's that John has this, you know, flaw, he's a gay man, and he knows that he shouldn't have married Catherine, he shouldn't be in this relationship, but he knows that's why the law should change, why society should change, because men and women shouldn't be forced to be married if one of them doesn't fancy the other. And But in order to make that case, in order to change society and in order to change the law, he has to push out in a direction, push himself into the public in a way which hurts his wife and family. So it's a kind of indissoluble problem, which which then just, so then you ultimately push the blame out on the society, but you show how the society warps these people's lives. And that's why it's important all the way through the book to that it ties in. I think the women characters are just as important as the male characters. And the women characters allow us to think about women's rights and the position of women in direct relationship to the problem of homosexuality and how that affects people. It is about prejudice, structural prejudice, difficulty succumbing past roles that have been kind of pressed onto you from birth. So yes, I hope it's a book about men and women and society, and not just about spunky gays.
But you know, it's good to put some spunky gays in. They should be in everything. I want to say that my main take from the whole book. A lot of things were definitely worse in the 19th century, but the quality of the postal system was second to none back then.
Yeah, it was a great time. It was a great time.
You could write a letter and get it sent like the same day, like 2 hours later.
Yeah, I think in London it's something incredible. Like they were doing. Well, I'm not going to get this right. Let's not pretend I'm going to get this right. But it's something that at least I think maybe 6 deliveries a day. So yes, right. you could write a letter at breakfast and it would get to someone, you know, by 11 a.m. They could write back to you. You could get that after lunch. You could write another one back to them. They could write another one back to you. So you could have a rolling communication, you know, like texting all through the day. And it's it is incredible. And to think that we've actually. I think this all the time about the past, that we are very, there's a good phrase, the condescension of posterity. And I do think we look down on the past and we assume that everything they had was worse or that they didn't have the things we had. And it's often the case that they actually just had different versions of the things we had, we have now. Slightly less convenient, but they still filled the need. It wasn't like they were all, you know, chewing on rocks. They were living, you know, very sophisticated and interesting lives. And sometimes we've gone backwards. And I do think, talking about that rich poor thing, I do think in the 19th century, more people were thinking more intelligently and humanely about capitalism and its effects and how societies are built and constructed and whether they are fair or not. I think there was better thinking going on then than there is now. And yet we have this prejudice of the Victorians being very, you know, uncaring and you know, factory owners and children getting mauled in machines. But, you know, and that, yes, that was going on, but people... It's actually happening now too. And actually, I think we're probably more ignorant and less reflective about that now. So I don't know what you said to set me off on this now.
It was all about the post.
I'm like at the dinner table at Christmas.
And there's a suggestion in the book, have I got this right, that gay men are unable to whistle. Have I remembered that correctly? Doesn't hold up necessarily, or you know, can you prove otherwise?
If you were to ask me to whistle now, we would confirm. Yes, I was talking to the great Irish novelist Colm Tobin the other day, and this came up, and we both he's gay as well, and we both admitted we couldn't whistle.
So right,
that pretty much proves it. And he also suggested that gay men can't run, which I'm prepared to endorse.
Okay.
There were lots of very strange Victorian theories about homosexuality, which there was not being able to whistle, there was having short fingers, there was having wide...
Oh, no, that's me. I've got very short fingers.
Yeah. Well, we've got an eye on you.
I'm safe. I can't whistle very well, though.
It's a 2 out of 3 thing. And wide hips were one of them. And there was all sorts of very strange theories about the rectum and where pleasurable sensations had been sort of misdirected from the penis to the rectum. And so there was a lot of that. I didn't want to go, if I'd put too much of that into the book, I think it would have become a sort of caricature version of itself. But there was lots of very curious thinking.
Yeah.
But it was part of an intellectual moment. You know, people at least were thinking about it. They weren't just hanging people. So that's some progress.
That's very interesting to say. Look, the book is really fascinating. I want to talk. I listened to it as an audio book, which I would recommend. It's with a novel, it's not always the best way to enjoy a novel, because it can be. And this is quite a complex novel, and it's. I think an audio book is. I was surprised the audio book held my attention as well as it does, because there's lots to think about, but also there's a lot of characters. So you didn't choose to do the audiobook yourself, but I think you've maybe chosen well in that regard, and no, only because the reader is so good.
Yes, it's read by Freddie Fox, who is a very good actor indeed, and so it's really a performance of the book, which I don't listen to audiobooks, so I was very impressed actually by the sense that I was, and quite moved really, when these voices have been in your head all that time, to sort of feel the book come alive. I think he does a great, because the book has lots of kind of big dramatic conversations, and he does a great job at sort of bringing those to life, I think.
I think he does. You have in the audiobook, there's also a talk between the two of you about the audiobook. I thought he might ask you some questions about being the author of it, but it was mainly
imagine how I felt when I was told I would be the interviewer and he would be the star.
But I think he hadn't done an audiobook before, and I think just worked way too hard at it for what I imagine the money was. He'd put in a lot of thought about each character and used different colours through the book of marker pens, so he knew which character was which. But he'd really, it is incredible, because, it's a serious subject, and it's a subject that's going to make you think a lot. And the emotion comes across, and I think not all audiobooks are... I tend to listen to a lot of factual books on audiobook, which is a very good way, I think, to get those, especially with the author reading them. But this one, it does feel like, in places, it feels like a radio play as much as a novel, and that is a compliment to say. So well done, and I would recommend the audiobook, as I nearly always do. I nearly always recommend the audiobook, but it's very good for this one. I was at the book launch for this book, so that's the first time that's happened. I just came in. You can get into these places. It's fine. There's no one stopping you.
How we met.
There was free wine and everything. Unfortunately, I'm not drinking, but I would have had it otherwise. And I met your family, who are from Middlesbrough. I met your mum and dad, and I also met your aunties, who I have to say, if you hadn't told me they were from Middlesbrough, if you'd put them in front of me, they look like three. If they just were basically what I imagine Middlesbrough women to look like, the three different kinds.
Especially when my Auntie Jan, she came up to get her book signed. Her entire shirt was open from neck to waist. Bra out, belly out. It was an extraordinary scene. So she was really representing, actually.
She was good. But it was delightful to meet them. And we had a chat for a while. And I think you'd mentioned this, but I'd forgotten. We were talking about where in Middlesbrough my grandparents lived and all that sort of stuff. And I said, oh, my granddad was a headmaster in Middlesbrough. And she said, not Mr. Herring. And I said, yes. And this is your Auntie Jan, I believe. And she said, oh, he was horrible. And it said, I couldn't, that was a sort of weird historical disconnect, because your aunties are not like ancient, they're middle-aged ladies. And it just feels to me like my granddad was a headmaster like in the 40s or 50s, but he must have stretched, into the 60s, I'm guessing. And he was a headmaster of a primary school, so they would have been young. A, I was surprised, I couldn't quite get over the disconnect that there was that connection. But B, I just enjoyed so much that there wasn't even a question of going, oh, this is his grandson. I won't say how scared of him I was.
No, it was very triggering for them, actually.
Yeah.
They told me afterwards, you know, they had to go and have a lie down. It's like Hamlet seeing his father's ghost, seeing you on the in the bookshop. Terrible, terrible scene. Yes, you know, they didn't hold back. They really thought he was a loathsome man and actually ruined their childhoods. So.
Well, I went on Facebook. I just wanted to defend Geoffrey Herring. He's, you know, he's an historical character. I haven't made him up like you have with your ones.
Yeah.
And I went
Wait till the second novel.
Yes. I searched for the school, Green Lane School, and the only one comment on Facebook was what a brilliant headmaster he was and what a terrifying headmaster the next headmaster was. So maybe your aunt has got him mixed up with another headmaster. He was a very old-fashioned man, you see. And I think that's interesting because my parents married in 1959. As a 22 or 23 year old, and you know, then the 60s changed everything. But my granddad always felt very much like a product of the Edwardian age. It was quite, and I find it hard to imagine him being the headmaster of a primary school. He was great when I was a bit older, but he wasn't very good with young kids.
Yeah. Someone who liked administering corporal punishment as much as he did. To let him loose in a primary school was...
Well, there we've learned something about family. But it's, you know, we may be related somewhere along the line. You know, there's every chance that we're related somewhere. It is sort of weird that Middlesbrough...
Which would make both our relationships probably illegal.
So it's odd the way these things interlink and come back. I think we should get back to calling people sexual inverts as well, which is the phrase that comes up a lot in this book. There's the Victorian description.
If you can't whistle, you're an invert.
You know, pervert feels like a quite aggressive word. An invert just feels like you're an invert. Come on in. You're an invert. It's fine. You're welcome. Yeah. You know.
I like come on invert. That would be the title of the musical of this book.
And so, look, I wanted to talk to you before we go. I wanted, because this, you had an incredible bidding war. This is your first novel, and it was people going crazy for it. And before it was even, you know, so you had publishers bidding for this. How did that feel? I mean, obviously not many people get their first novels even published, so how did that come about? Does that feel like a responsibility when before you've even had a book published that people are sort of clamoring over you in that way?
Well, it was very strange. I mean, as I say, the book has been a long time in the making, and you spend a lot of time obviously on your own and at various points. It's so, I'm experiencing this now with trying to write my next novel. I just hate it. I just wish I was promoting books all the time and not writing them, because it's so unpleasant. It's so difficult and stressful, and it makes me quite sad, really. So you have all that, and then I finally got this bloody thing done. And it was amazing, really. My agent sent it to publishers on a Friday evening, and on Monday morning, I was my boyfriend Duncan and I, your brother-in-law, we were driving from London to the northeast, and we hadn't even turned out of the road. We hadn't turned out of the road when I got the first email saying a publisher was interested, you know, had read it over the weekend, loved it, was interested. And by the time we completed this five or so hour drive to the northeast, there were four publishers interested. I had a series of meetings scheduled, and my agent had rang me up and said, have you got an idea for a second book? Could we get a quick paragraph down by the end of the day? So it was kind of completely, you know, 0 to 60. And that was in the UK, and then the whole thing started again in America. And it was just, you know, I hadn't even been to America at that point. So it was a very strange experience, feeling like I was encountering an alien civilization.
Well, it's, you know, I can understand why it is, you know, it is, it does, I was going to say it immediately grabs you, but that sort of is what happens in the beginning. I can understand that. But it is sort of an extraordinary, you know, it's the dream, isn't it? It's what every author would dream of. I've written a book and here we go. I imagine this would make a great film or TV series as well. Is that in the running yet, or is that,
well,
as part of the rights?
I mean, if you're interested, just say the word. I think it would make a great film. No one has yet come forward to say so in direct terms, but right. I think it would. I can see it.
Well, I am always cast as inverts. I'm going to call them now. That makes me feel better about it. So I can be the bloke wanking into some piss under a tree. I can do that.
That's my best scene you've just given away.
That's basically it. No, you don't need to read the book now. I'll give you the best bit.
That's actually the final chapter.
I always ask if there's any books you're reading or have read recently that you would like to recommend. And this is, you're a very high brand. This isn't like, a toilet book that I usually have, QI Book of Facts. This isn't Fesshole. I'm expecting some very high quality recommendations of other books. Do you have any books that you're reading that you would recommend?
I think over Christmas and the first weeks of the new year, I was reading H.G. Wells's sort of early realist novels. So kind of not the sci-fi novel, the great sci-fi novels, The Time Machine and War of the Worlds, but actually these novels he wrote about ordinary life in London in this kind of first decade of the 20th century. So Love and Mr. Lewisham, Mr. Polly, Tono Bungay. And actually they are very, very funny books. Mr. Polly especially is a kind of laugh out loud gold star banger.
Okay.
And so The History of Mr. Polly by H.G. Wells is very, very funny book, full of slapstick and some very kind of Dickensian humor. There's a very funny wedding. There's some badly behaved relatives. It's a great book actually. And I think it was very, very, very famous and it seems to have lost its renown. So I would recommend that.
Okay, we'll try and get H.G. Wells on a future episode of this. We'll see how that goes. Yeah. And you're very good. You buy lovely books for me at Christmas. You, in fact, bought The Ruin of All the Witches, which we had Malcolm on as a, and Malcolm also, I got to meet at your book launch for the first time properly, having talked to him on this. Yes. So that was nice. And So thank you for that. That was a gift in itself. And thank you for coming on. I'll see you next time you're around at Pat and Chris's.
yeah, see you soon. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Do go and read The New Life by Tom Crew. Not sure who our guest next week will be, but it'll be someone amazing. They probably won't have got a book deal as good as Tom got, but we'll see.
Might be Pat and Chris.
It might be Pat and Chris. Yeah. Might have my daughter's written some stories. I'll get her on. She'll be fine.
Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you, Tom. That was awesome.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. gofasterstripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.